History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Ferdinand Magellan was ready to conquer the world with nothing but a few loyal soldiers. He had already discovered vast new swaths of the globe and crossed the world's largest ocean. Capturing the small island in the Philippines seemed a trifle by comparison. Magellan's confidence was supreme. He faced down the islanders of Mactan with only 60 crew members, turning down the help of 1,000 natives in battle, offered by an allied Filipino leader, and he fought this battle in order to avenge an insult. But it proved to be a rash call. After a short spurt of fighting, the islanders quickly overwhelmed the small forces. He issued a retreat order, but still kept fighting himself, determined to prevail against the savages. Some of his men stayed behind out of loyalty to their general captain, but the timid peeled away from the fight. His small contingent shrank to a compact circle. The last of his soldiers were picked off by natives until the enemies ran Magellan through with bamboo spears. The captain, the first to cross the Pacific and lead his crew on a voyage of starvation and death, was killed by believing that he would forever beat the odds. He collapsed into the water and bled out. The ocean that Magellan thought he had conquered engulfed him. His death is a sad testimony to the transformation that occurred over the life of the famed explorer. Antonio Pigafetta, an Italian navigator whom Magellan hired to keep records of the voyage, and from whom we know the most about his life and voyage, wrote that he was a charismatic leader at the beginning of their adventure to circumnavigate the globe. But something happened along the way that hardened his sympathies and turned him into someone who is paranoid and untrusting. While contemporary historians are more blunt about his downward spiral, Magellan, according to historian Helen Nadar of the University of Arizona, wrote in Smithsonian Magazine, he was apparently able to attract a lot of people to him and was very loyal to his Portuguese buddies, but once at sail, he became very different. He started treating his officers in a cruel way. He was very angry because some of the people mutinied. His attitude toward his crew members was a calcified form of stubbornness. Yet that very same attitude likely allowed him to survive the terrifying voyage. Maintaining discipline among his ships in the middle of the Pacific when everyone was starving took incredible resolve. And much of his personality can be understood by the circumstances of his upbringing. A Portuguese noble by birth, Ferdinand Magellan, was nevertheless accustomed to hardship, and he was a pioneer of early exploration. We're continuing our series on travelers and explorers in this episode, and in the first few episodes, we looked at medieval explorers. Now we're jumping into the age of discovery. We're looking at whom I consider to be the most important explorer at this time. I'm skipping over Christopher Columbus or Vasco da Gama, and looking at someone who truly started the age of globalization, who laid down the tracks, well, I mean metaphorically, of course, because we're talking about ships here, but laid down the tracks of global shipping routes and made it possible for nations or kingdoms like Spain and Portugal and others to set up global empires. So that's what we're going to be looking at in this episode. Magellan was born in 1480. He was educated by monks and later offered a position as a page to Queen Leonora, a circumstance engineered by his father, whose family was distantly related to the crown. He grew up at the dawn of the European Age of Discovery in a kingdom that led innovation and navigation in the nascent field of transoceanic ship travel. In previous decades, Portuguese figures arose, like Henry the Navigator, who were responsible for the development of European exploration and Portugal's head start in the imperial race for global domination. Naval explorers were able to venture on longer and longer voyages due to advances in maritime technology. Most importantly, the stern-mounted rudder, which allowed for the steering of larger ships than what had been conventionally used. Ships such as hulks were developed, then the carrack and the caravel, a small ship able to sail windward more than any other vessel in Europe at the time. These ships could hold enough supplies and crew members to last weeks or months at sea, making transoceanic voyages possible for late medieval Portugal. By the early 14th century, explorers rediscovered the Canary Islands and discovered the Madeira and the Azores, which are far out into the Atlantic Ocean. In 1415, Portugal captured the Moorish port of Ceuta in northern Morocco, An old base for Barbary pirates that long raided Portuguese coastal villages and acted as a chokehold that prevented European explorers from safely venturing south. With the threat of their crew's enslavement pacified, Henry the Navigator began sailing down Africa's western coast, searching for the source of the West African gold trade. They knew that gold was coming from the south, but it passed the hands of several traders and it became very expensive by the time it came up north. So going south along Africa was sort of like a early version or a beta version of going out to the Spice Islands to find the source of all these valuable spices. Henry the Navigator was able to succeed where previous voyages had failed. Notably, the 1346 voyage of Jaume Ferrer, who sailed down the coast of Africa in an Italian galley but never returned. And Henry succeeded due to his sailing vessel being lighter and faster than older Mediterranean ships and being able to negotiate the African coast. Portugal sought to step beyond its status as a small rump state on the Iberian Peninsula. Henry wished to bypass the Muslim territories of Africa and trade directly with West Africa by the sea, finding Christian allies in the south, at least they hoped, and ideally accessing the rich spice trade of the Indies. At the time, trade in cloves, nutmeg, cinnamon, myrrh, frankincense, and pewter was monopolized by Arabs, Turks, and other intermediaries, vastly inflating the price before reaching Europe. Direct access to these markets would multiply the wealth of any European who reached them first, and a small sack of spices in Western Europe could be sold and earn enough revenue to purchase a house and provide for years of financial security. Thus, the Portuguese steadily expanded their trade network. Henry the Navigator's captains reached Cape Bujador in modern-day Morocco in 1434. After the mid-century invention of the caravel, which could sail safely on the open ocean, Portuguese navigators pushed even further south on a systematic basis. Historians estimate that they advance on an average of 1 degree a year. Senegal was reached in 1445, Cape Verde in 1456, Sierra Leone in 1460, and Sao Tome in 1471. They found a thriving gold trade among Berber and Arab Muslims and built a factory in Sao Tome in 1481 to refine the metal. In 1488, Bartolomeo Dias rounded the southern tip of Africa, proving wrong Ptolemy's belief that the Indian Ocean was landlocked and opened up the Indian Ocean to European exploration. King John II was so optimistic of the discovery of the sea route, he renamed the cape the Cape of Good Hope. Vasco da Gama rounded the cape in 1497 with 170 men, reaching Calcutta a year later. They returned in 1500 in triumph as the first Europeans to sail directly to India. The small rump state of Portugal was on the verge of dominating global oceanic commerce. However, rivalry with Spain intensified throughout the early years of the 16th century. The Kingdom of Spain, which was newly unified under Ferdinand and Isabella, sought to best its rival in controlling new trade routes following its completion of the Reconquista, with the fall of the last Islamic state in Iberia, which was Granada, in 1492. Following Columbus's famed voyage to the New World between 1492 and 1503, the competition threatened war between the two states. Pope Alexander VI intervened in 1494, issuing a papal bull, the Treaty of Tordesillas, that stated all lands west and south of the axial line, 370 leagues west of the Azores, belonged to Portugal, giving them control over Africa, Asia, and modern-day Brazil. Spain was blocked from the African sea route to India, but it refused to cede all trade in the Old World to its rival and kept its eye on expanding its influence along new trade lines in Europe, Africa, and Asia. Spanish King Charles I, the future Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, hired Magellan as captain to discover a direct sea route to Asia. They would surprise their Portuguese rivals by circumnavigating the globe and reaching their Asian trading partners from the west rather than the east, considered at the time to be a radically backward route. So that was a lot of background information right there, but you need to understand that what Magellan is doing, he's not just going straight from the Middle Ages to sailing around the world, but there are decades and decades of exploration and advances in maritime technology that enable him to do what he does at this time. Well, the story of his swapping allegiance from Portugal to Spain requires a biographical sketch of his early years. In his youth, Magellan was exposed to the science of celestial navigation, among many other subjects. And his education benefited that of a young royal at the dawn of the Renaissance. He studied music, dance, hunting, horsemanship, military arts, geography, and astronomy. These subjects also formed the standard curriculum in Portugal by the king's decree. It was a step to groom new bureaucrats and administrators and soldiers and navigators and admirals for the self-proclaimed sea trading empire. His parents died when he was 10, leaving him in the employ of Queen Lenore as a page in her royal court. In 1505, the 25-year-old and his brother Diogo joined Francisco de Almeida's 22-ship fleet to Portuguese India, only 5 years after da Gama and his crew's glorious return to Lisbon. Ferdinand Magellan remained in India for 8 years, participating in numerous battles for Portuguese supremacy. In 1509, he earned commendations for valor by protecting the Portuguese embassy to Malacca. Magellan was wounded in battle and distinguished himself as a competent warrior and accomplished sailor, earning several promotions and honors. He returned to Lisbon in 1512, but continued a correspondence with his friend Francisco Serrao, who was part of an expedition to find the fabled Spice Islands in Indonesia, the nerve center of the global spice trade. If an expedition could find the islands and secure a trade route back to Portugal, it would be more lucrative than discovering the formula for transmuting base metals into gold. Basically, you could earn more money than if you were making gold from scratch. Serrao continued to feed Magellan information about its whereabouts, and his letters provide crucial information in his decision to mount a new voyage. In 1514, however, Magellan found himself unemployed. Feuding powers in India implicated him in illegal trading with the Moroccans, and he lost the support of the Portuguese crown. His superiors suspected him of being an opportunist, willing to betray his sovereign if a lucrative trade opportunity crossed his path. It proved to be an accurate suspicion in later years, but his weakened fidelity may have also owed to his treatment from the Portuguese crown. King Manuel I offered him no measure of good faith when he refused to compensate Magellan when pirates looted his ship. Nor was he paid when he fought in Morocco in the name of his homeland. Despite such poor treatment from his sovereign, Magellan appealed to him for support to lead an expedition to the Spice Islands. To do so would require a crew and a maneuverable caravel of his own. King Manuel ignored the request. Such slights had made Magellan grow tired of constantly petitioning to an uninterested king who only threw him irregular, life-endangering work with no prospect of commanding a voyage. The final straw was Magellan's humiliation by the king, who publicly refused his subject the kiss of fealty. Utterly disgraced, Magellan shook the dust off his shoes upon Portugal and went directly to its arch-rival, Spain. In 1517, Magellan arrived in Seville. He spoke little of the language and had few political connections. He compensated by befriending a well-connected Portuguese officer, Diogo Barbosa, and marrying his daughter, Beatriz. Magellan spent the next 4 years convincing King Charles I to fund a voyage west toward the Spice Islands, since Portugal had already found an attractive route east. With his friends and fellow navigators, Barbosa and John of Lisbon, he devised a plan to sail around the southernmost tip of South America and cross unknown leagues of ocean to reach their destination. This was an unprecedented route that, if successful, would constitute the first known circumnavigation of the globe. Like any oceanic voyage of the time, it was fraught with danger. The longitudinal line created by the Treaty of Tordesillas extended around the globe through the poles, but nobody knew where it extended in the eastern hemisphere. Thus, Magellan didn't know on which side the Spice Islands were located. He assumed them to be much closer and imagined the Pacific to be the size of the Atlantic Ocean. Geographic knowledge of the day agreed with his assumptions. The voyage would most likely last a few months more than Columbus's simple 5-week jaunt to the West Indies. They would return to Spain quickly, the officers and crew suffering nothing more than mild sunburns and scraggly beards, a few torn sails, and creaking holds that were bursting with precious spices. The king was enthusiastic, not only funding the expedition, but drawing up the charter for 2 years of preparation. A call was put out for any interested sailor to join the voyage. Few responded at first. Veteran seamen refused to support Magellan's voyage, perhaps because of his Portuguese background. The call was then changed. The crown loosened its standards and allowed nearly anyone to apply, even non-Spanish subjects or those with a criminal background. Freelance sailors, crewhands, and brigands applied from across the Mediterranean, whether from nearby kingdoms and principalities such as Venice and Genoa, or further afield from kingdoms along the Mediterranean coast, like the North African Islamic States or the Ottoman Empire on the Levant. In August 1519, Magellan disembarked with a crew of 280 men among the 5 ships of his fleet, the Concepcion, the San Antonio, the Santiago, the Victoria, and the flagship Trinidad. 4 of the ships were 3- or 4-masted sailing ships called carracks. The Trinidad was a caravel. Each vessel held massive stores of supplies to last the men for weeks and months at sea. With plans to resupply in stops along the Canary Islands, Cape Verde, and South American port towns. No shipping clerk could have guessed how much they dangerously underestimated the needs of the voyage. Magellan left the Spanish port of Sancar de Barrameda with cannons firing to salute the fleet. He sailed into the Atlantic with a multi-ethnic crew that spoke various languages. They were Spaniards, Portuguese, Greeks, Sicilians, English, French, Germans, and North Africans. Strained relations between the crew, united by neither flag or language or religion, showed immediately. They were cramped together in close quarters and faced the prospect of months together on the open sea. Different naval customs and sailing traditions led to frequent conflict. Officers preferred sailors who shared their own nationality. In fact, the only thing that united much of the crew was a general dislike of Magellan. Due to the divisions between the crew members, mutiny broke out shortly after the voyage began. The masters of three ships attempted to kill him before the fleet even reached South America. A fourth vessel would eventually abandon the fleet and return to Europe. It was the first Federation fleet that was multiracial and multi-ethnic, but as we can see here, there were problems from the beginning. To compound Magellan's problems, King Manuel of Portugal ordered his capture and imprisonment before his departure, even ordering a naval detachment to pursue the fleet. Ultimately, however, by September 20th, 1519, the same summer that Cortes marauded through Mexico, Magellan's fleet sailed away unscathed, heading for South America. By December, the fleet had reached Brazil, where they restocked and continued southward. Inclement weather barred the way, with fierce storms and high winds. The men anchored off of Patagonia to wait out the season before attempting the passage into the unknown seas to the east by means of a water passage around the Americas. Once the weather calmed, the fleet raised its anchor, charted their course, and continued south. And they kept going south and further south and further south and further south. Their journey dragged on from days to weeks, and the crew grew restless. Nobody knew when they could cross to the Pacific, but they all had assumed it would have happened much sooner. Magellan himself remained steadfast, but he was equally confused as to their true location. The crew journeyed into the unknown. There were no maps or local guides to tell them the distance to the southern tip of the continent. Furthermore, it was well known among the crew that the natives of South America were hostile to the Spaniards and would give them no information. In earlier voyages, they had captured explorers and even eaten one. When the crew arrived at the passage between the two oceans, Magellan thought it to be a large bay. South of the mainland, across a tumultuous strait, lay a wind-battered island, which he guessed to be a continuation of the continent. Magellan named it the Tierra del Fuego, or Land of Fire, for its pyrotechnic landscape. He was a thorough explorer, however, and investigated the passage. In spring, the Santiago was sent to scout a passage around Tierra del Fuego, and it was nearly destroyed by the treacherous waters and unable to sail again for months. Four ships remained to continue onward in search of a passage. He dispatched two ships ahead to explore and determine if the body of water was a bay, as they had already encountered many times. He ordered them to return in 5 days. A massive storm battered their fleet as they waited. He assumed the ships to be destroyed and prepared to depart on the fifth day. But shortly before the fleet's departure, the ships returned, claiming discovery of the transoceanic passage.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Magellan chose between two dangerous passages, opting to sail through the strait rather than risk the longer route around. Despite news of the passage from the scouts, his argumentative crew balked at the proposition, doubting they had reached the strait. The crew of the San Antonio flatly refused to go and abandoned the mission for home. But Magellan persevered. For 33 days and 344 miles, the remaining sailors battled the strait, losing the bulk of their supplies. When they finally emerged into the unknown ocean that Magellan named the Pacific for its peaceful waters, it was a significant maritime triumph. By arriving at the Pacific by sea, he avoided the challenges of a land crossing, which would involve breaking down the ships, hauling supplies over unknown territory, perhaps jungle, battling hostile natives, likely succumbing to foreign diseases or dangerous wildfire, and having to rebuild the ships on the other seashore. Magellan named the treacherous waters the Strait of All Saints, but in the future it was renamed in his honor as the Strait of Magellan. The crossing of the strait was treacherous, but there, nature itself held a beautiful mysteriousness.
The alien Arctic landscape was a wonder to behold to the crew members, and it was also equally stunning and savage. Lawrence Bergreen describes it in the book Over the Edge of the World as follows. Consisting of packed snow and ice, the glaciers never rested. They cracked, they groaned, they roared, and they threatened to decompose and tumble onto the beaches and water below. Their crystalline towers leaned out over the water in irregular columns like rotting teeth in a decaying jaw. They inclined even more precariously over the placid water until one column after another, warmed by the sun and buffeted by the wind, caved and collapsed amid a cloud of icy dust with a shattering report, followed by a drum-like roll of thunder, low and resonant, announcing destruction. To everyone's surprise, the glaciers were neither white nor gray, but a light, almost iridescent blue that in the crevices and seams darkened to a deep azure. The countless chunks of ice broke off from the glaciers, some as large as a whale, others as small as a penguin, and they had the same enigmatic bluish cast as they bobbed past the ships, an armada of sculpted ice drifting towards a mysterious location. Well, Magellan and his fleet thought the worst was behind them after reaching the Pacific. They gathered final provisions from the mainland and prepared for the Pacific crossing. The crew, like most Europeans at the time, thought Asia and the Philippines to be much closer than they were, little more than an Atlantic crossing, which rarely exceeded several weeks. Any trip longer contradicted conventional wisdom among sailors about oceanic distance and geographical considerations of the Earth's circumference. Even if the voyage were longer than expected, there would most likely be islands along the way to restock their food and water, and allow the sailors to encounter native women or to satisfy their baser urges. Popular travelogues of the day, such as accounts by Marco Polo and Vasco da Gama, described Indonesia and the Philippines as thousands of close islands, and Magellan anticipated the same. He set a northwest course in order to avoid encountering any Portuguese ships. But this new ocean seemed endless, much larger than anyone had anticipated. Magellan and John of Lisbon had calculated a journey lasting days, but league after league passed with no sight of land. The crew began to suffer as food stocks dwindled and their water supplies spoiled. Their provisions of beans, lentils, pork, cheese, and fish shrank, then disappeared. Preserving food through canning wouldn't be invented for three more centuries, so the crew made do with biscuits, the mainstay of their voyage. However, it was barely edible when fresh, and it crumbled and turned to dust when it was dry. Crew members stretched it out by adding meat to the ship's rats, then they added sawdust. In their hunger, they gnawed oxhide, covering the sails, to trick their senses into thinking they had consumed a meal. The stench of rotten food and disease filled the holes and cabs. But the biggest threat to their health in the course of the voyage had nothing to do with rotten food or starvation. It was a disease that would haunt the rest of their expedition and all maritime travel until the 20th century. The disease, which broke out in the absence of fresh food containing vitamin C, was scurvy. And the illness was no mere vitamin deficiency. This was something that haunted crews, and it loomed in the back of their minds whenever a fleet blew off course or too much time had passed between ports. The ship's officers and surgeons feared uttering the word aloud. They knew the terrible symptoms of the disease, which put its victims through severe pain and disfigurement before they succumbed to a terrible death. First, their teeth loosened and their thoughts became confused. Then bruises appeared all over their bodies. Their gums turned black, their eyes and hairlines bled, teeth fell out of their heads, sores never healed, and madness and delusion set in. They became sensitive to any sort of loud noise, whether a pounding hammer or a firearm blast, which was a lethal proposition in the open sea when the sound of cannon fire could travel for months. Insanity fell in the final stages, and sailors would see no problem jumping into the ocean as the boat pitched during a thunderstorm. Favorable winds pushed their sails west, but the fleet remained at sea for 98 days and traveled 7,000 miles with nothing but endless blue horizon. In the course of the Pacific crossing, Magellan lost 19 sailors and one boat. They hobbled onto the Mariana Islands and eventually to Guam, and were basically a crew of sunburned skeletons. There the natives, known as the Chamorros, came out to the sides of the boat in their outrigged canoes with lateen sails. They quickly boarded the ship, stealing any supplies they could. Crew members fired crossbows and muskets against the intruders. A battle on the ship hull had broken out, but Magellan ordered his men to stop. The islanders took his command as an act of good faith. They began offering food to the sailors and traded with them. But these good sentiments quickly evaporated. The native boarding party took advantage of their malnourished state and stole a skiff. Historians have argued as to the islanders' intentions. They may have stolen the vessel as part of a ritual, but with the intention to return it and show their benevolence. Whatever their intentions, there was a language barrier, so we can't really know for sure, Magellan refused to let their first encounter on the other side of the Pacific end in such an insult. He ordered a landing party to attack their village, burn their houses, assault the islanders, and recover their skiff. Magellan cast his eternal aspersions on the natives, naming their islands the Island of the Thieves. The fleet continued to the northwest, reaching the Philippines on March 28, 1521. When they arrived at the archipelago, which Magellan first thought to be the Spice Islands, he found it in the midst of a war between two rival warlords, Raja Humabon and Chief Lapu-Lapu. Magellan befriended Raja Humabon, speaking to him through his servant and interpreter, Enrique, who had been with him since his days in Malacca. Conditions here were much better for the expedition's goal of establishing a European presence in the South Pacific. Magellan convinced the chief and many of his subjects to convert to Christianity. The crew members themselves relaxed in the tropical setting. They drank palm wine and fraternized with the local women. Magellan became a blood brother to Raja, with whom he felt a strong kinship. The chief showed him the luxury of the trading isle and its assortment of gold, exotic food, and women. Magellan saw an opportunity. He desired to make the chieftain supreme over his rival tribes and pledged loyalty to the King of Spain. This would have consolidated Spanish control over the Philippines. He also decided to become the exclusive European merchant and official for one of the Filipino islands in order to salvage his miscalculation that took the fleet thousands of miles north of the Spice Islands. Magellan decided that a show of force of muskets and cannons against crude spears would cow the enemy natives into submission. He prepared for an attack with only 60 half-armed men to show them his invulnerability. The Battle of Mactan soon began. The account of his death comes to us from the diary of Antonio Pigafetta. The navigator and record keeper recounts the captain general's bravery in the last moments of his life, but also the cost of his hubris. Magellan held the advantage of weaponry, but he planned the attack without taking into account the reefs along the island's beach. This prevented the ships from coming within firing range of the shore, nullifying the advantage of the cannons, which he counted on. The soldiers then filled the landing craft, taking them close to the shore until they could go no further due to large rocks in the water. 49 of the soldiers leapt into the water, which was thigh deep, waiting more than two crossbow flights before reaching the shore. 11 soldiers stayed behind in the boats. The landing party reached the shore, musket in hand. They stared down three divisions of natives, who numbered more than 1,500. The islanders charged the 5 dozen Europeans, screaming battle cries and flanking the group. The musketeers and crossbowmen fired at the natives for half an hour, but their weapons were ineffective at such a long range. The musket fire had a wide spread and barely pierced the natives' thin wood shields. Magellan ordered the criminal crew to cease fire, but they ignored him. Their ammunition soon depleted. The natives then made their attack. They rushed the Europeans, firing arrows and hurling spears hardened with fire and stone and mud. They darted and pierced the sailors' unprotected legs and feet. The captain general ordered a desperate final call for psychological warfare. He dispatched a few men to burn nearby houses in order to terrify the islanders. 20 or 30 of their simple huts were soon smoldering kindling. The natives, seeing their dwellings burn, were only roused to greater anger. They killed the two arsonists and made a final assault on the main Spanish force. Hundreds charged the beach. They shot Magellan through the leg with a poisoned arrow. He ordered a retreat, but the sailors fled in disorderly panic. Only 6 or 8 remained with Magellan. They steadily moved backwards, firing crossbow shots in knee-deep waters to keep the natives at bay. The islanders continued their volley of spears, aiming most of their fire at Magellan. His helmet was knocked off twice, but as Pigafetta recounts, he always stood firmly like a good knight. They fought for more than an hour, refusing to move backward. A native threw a spear in Magellan's face. The Portuguese captain general turned and killed him with his lance, which he left in the Indian's body. Magellan attempted to redraw his sword, but could only do so halfway because he suffered a wound in his arm from a bamboo spear. The Indians then hurled themselves upon him. One wounded him in the leg with a large cutlass. Magellan fell face down. They rushed him with spears, thrusting into him, leaving him to bleed out like a lamb on a sacrificial altar. His soldiers recount that as he lay dying, he looked back to see whether the sailors were all in their boats. They looked upon him, beholding him dead, and retreated to the landing boats that were already pulling off. Many of the crew watched him die from a safe distance. Some may have been able to save him, but preferred to continue their voyage without the little-loved commander at the helm. Betraying Magellan took a deadly toll on the crew. He instructed in his will that his servant Enrique be set free, but the crew members kept him as a translator. In revenge for defiling Magellan's wish, and more importantly, for continuing his illegal slavery, he schemed with Chief Humabon, who had much less affinity for the Western sailors than for their dead Captain General. During a feast between the islanders and the crew members, he ordered many Europeans massacred. The remaining crew didn't have enough men to sail the three boats. On May 2nd, they burned the Concepcion, leaving only the Trinidad and Victoria. The officers discussed amongst themselves whether to return to Spain by sailing west along the Indian coast and around Africa, or make a final attempt to push south and reach the Spice Islands. After much deliberation, they decided to make a gambit for the islands and secure wealth for their troubles. If not, they would return to Spain completely destitute, with nothing but their lives. So the decision was made. Juan Sebastian Elcano, a Basque merchant, led the two ships to the Spice Islands, leaving on June 21st. With the help of local traders, they were guided to Brunei and Borneo by Moro pilots that understood navigating the shallow waters. They anchored off of Brunei for over a month, slowly working south. On November 6th, the 115-man crew arrived at the Maluku Islands, or the Spice Islands, located in archipelago of Indonesia. There, the sailors negotiated a trade agreement with the Sultan of Tidore. He loaded up the ship's hulls with cloves, and the spice was literally worth its weight in gold. The mission, despite all its troubles, had been salvaged, and remember, this is about 6 months' further journey from where they were in the Philippines to reach the Spice Islands. But now they had to get home. This would be an equally treacherous journey as their earlier voyages across the Pacific and through the shallow waters of the Philippines. Tens of thousands of miles separated the South Pacific from Spain. The flagship Trinidad wasn't seaworthy anymore. It stayed behind for repairs while the Victoria departed on December 21st. The Trinidad attempted to return to Spain by way of the Pacific to avoid the Portuguese and a naval skirmish that would guarantee a loss for the battered Spanish vessel. Ironically, the ship was later captured by the Portuguese anyway, who were hunting Magellan. They seized the ship's cargo and imprisoned its crew for years on Ternate. The Trinidad later wrecked there in a storm. Elcano captained the second ship, the Victoria, which traveled west around Africa. The return was nearly as harrowing as the outward journey, and equally hunger-ridden due mostly to the harassment from the Portuguese, who controlled many islands and ports on the route back to Europe by way of the Indian and African coast, and who labeled them pirates in Portuguese territory. A price was on their heads. The 31 crew members of the Victoria landed on an island in the Indian Ocean to purchase slaves. They had no money, so they offered cloves in return to have enough men to be able to man the masts and make the ship functional. The Portuguese in command of the island threw 13 of the men in prison. The other 18 left behind their shipmates and sailed straight for Spain. They sailed around Africa, staggering home. The crew was starved, unable to eat the cloves that filled their holdings, as useless to their hunger as seawater was for their thirst. On September 6, 1522, the battered ship approached the port of Sanlúcar de Barrameda. The 18 men and the three captives, all malnourished, wearing tattered rags and guiding the boat with equally tattered sails, entered the harbor. Years of sunburn and scurvy covered their bodies with boils. Their tongues were swollen, they could barely walk or speak. Lookouts on the shore dispatch a boat to lead the vessel through the harbor in order to reach Seville. They were confused and terrified by this strange sight. When the sailors were able to clean themselves up and taste bread and wine once again for years without them, they presented themselves at the Spanish court to give an account of their voyage. There, the king treated them as heroes. He commended them for their incredible voyage, claiming so many foreign lands for Spain, and succeeding in establishing a route to the Spice Islands. He further congratulated them in succeeding in the mission against all reasonable expectation and bringing back the priceless cargo safely. The boat's hold of 381 sacks of cloves was worth more than the cost of the original fleet. The voyage managed to turn a profit despite all of its incredible, terrible hardships. And there's not many other voyages where you lose 4 out of 5 ships in the fleet and 90% of all the crew members, but would still be considered a success. More importantly, the crew had achieved an ambition as old as naval exploration. They were the first to circumnavigate the globe. Upon their first stop at a port in the African coast during their return trip, in which they were almost in Spanish waters, the sailors discovered a paradox in their ship logs. They recorded the day of the week as Wednesday, but the local day was actually Thursday. They demonstrated in their circling of the globe that an international dateline was necessary for future circumnavigations. The crew members split up and departed for their homes. Some give accounts of their journeys to their lords and patrons, from whom we have sources of the voyage today. They spoke of mutiny, orgies on distant shores, and the terror of an endless sea. The legend grew among sailors. Tales of Magellan's voyage astonished listeners. The expedition, which managed to succeed when so many other voyages in the age of exploration met disaster, was the most important journey of its kind ever attempted for many decades. The slain Captain Magellan himself suffered a much poorer reputation in Europe. The crew of the San Antonio, the boat that abandoned the fleet at the Strait of Magellan, arrived to Spain first and vilified him, maybe also as a way to cover themselves and justify why they abandoned the expedition, because they needed a very good reason to the sovereign who was funding their voyage at a considerable amount why they didn't continue on. The surviving crew members of the Victoria also vilified him, blaming his command for the conveniently dead commander for the mutiny and disaster suffered by the crew, distorting the facts in order for the Spanish king to absolve them of the blame. He granted them a royal pardon for any suspected wrongdoing at sea. The dead Magellan had at least one advocate in a sea of opportunists. That was Pigafetta, who championed him in his account of the voyage. He wished that, he wrote, the renown of so valiant and noble a captain will not be extinguished or fall into oblivion in our time. He set out to publish his journal of the circumnavigation in 1525, but it was printed in a Venetian dialect and mostly inaccessible to non-Italians. As a result, Magellan was despised in Spain, and especially in Portugal as a traitor, for years after the voyage. It wasn't until Pigafetta's account was translated did his reputation improve. But the scientific discoveries of the voyage were immediately declared an unqualified success by European natural philosophers and astronomers and geographers. The discrepancies between their logbooks and the date in Spain by one day created the concept of the international dateline. Their voyage of 14,460 leagues confirmed scientific estimates of the circumference of the Earth. America was definitely not a part of India, forever silencing Columbus's claims to the contrary. The Pacific Ocean was confirmed much larger than any scholar expected. Cartographers had a treasure trove of new data at their disposal. For the first time, maps displayed an accurate representation of Earth, even if there were considerable gaps to still fill in. Magellan's reputation has recovered over the centuries. His bravery and innovation and perseverance are now considered unparalleled during his time. He discovered and sailed through one of the most dangerous waterways in the world. He named the Pacific Ocean, circumnavigated the globe, albeit posthumously, and managed to lead a crew that threatened mutiny right from the very beginning. His pioneering spirit in an age of discovery lives on in geographic names such as the Strait of Magellan, and despite his poor reputation, he inspired Spanish and Portuguese sailors to open Eastern Asia to trade. Magellan accelerated the age of discovery and laid the groundwork for European colonialism, which in turn created 21st century globalization. His legacy carries influence today. New discoveries are associated with this iconic explorer. His crew first spotted the Magellanic Clouds, a cluster of galaxies visible in the night sky. NASA launched the Magellan spacecraft in 1989 to map the surface of Venus and measure the planetary gravitational field. In an unintentional homage to the Portuguese explorer, the one-ton probe took the long way to reach Venus, looping around the sun 1.5 times before arriving at the gaseous planet. Craters and landmarks on the moon and Mars bear his name, and all of this is a testimony to a man who fearlessly forged paths into the unknown. All right, well, that is all for this episode. The next episode, we're going to be jumping ahead and looking at someone who does a lot of work to fill in the incredible gaps of information in the Pacific Ocean, and that is Captain Cook. See you then. There you have it. That is all for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, The McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraza. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.